Okay. Appeal 071148, Donald Calloway versus Jesse Montgomery. Good morning, Mr. Monroe.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honors, we are here today because the Illinois courts committed two constitutional violations in trying Donald Calloway. First, the Illinois courts violated Apprendi and its progeny when it held that Mr. Calloway's prior 2002 federal mail fraud conviction qualified him for an extended term sentence for the mere fact that he could have been convicted of a completely different, uncharged, unproven crime of theft by deception.
Mr. Monroe, I understand your basic theory here to be that there is, in fact, no prior conviction for that, and thus we don't get into Almendarez-Torres or any of the rest of those exceptions to Apprendi?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. But there, on the other hand, A is a prior conviction from the federal side of the street, if you will. And it strikes me, as soon as Illinois has said, as it did in Hardin, that federal convictions might be a ground for enhancements, it's always the case, if there's a foreign conviction, if you will, in the federal courts, a conviction from a state court, and a state court, a conviction from a federal court or another state, you have to characterize what did that foreign conviction translate into in your home jurisdiction. And the Illinois courts here say that mail fraud conviction translated into theft by deception. So why doesn't that actually mean that that federal conviction is the sort of thing that the Illinois courts, if they wish, can use to enhance the sentence here?
Your Honor, let me respond to that in two points. First of all, we don't disagree that the federal conviction could qualify for terms of a sentencing statute. The question then becomes, how do you go about deciding how to equate a federal conviction to a state conviction?
What if Illinois had said, let me just stop you here, because what we may be arguing about is a question of state law, which is what worries me. What if Illinois had said any prior federal conviction for a felony can be used to enhance here? We don't care, if it's, whatever it could be called, wire fraud, it could be called anything, just any federal conviction for a felony. We wouldn't be here, would we? At least not on this point.
I don't think we would be here on this specific point.
So why isn't that effectively what Illinois, through its courts, has said it's doing here? It didn't kind of care what label was put on the federal conviction.
Well, because the Illinois statute, as it reads, Your Honor, says that it must be the same or greater class felony, not just any federal conviction. So then you get into an issue of, how do you take that federal conviction and equate it to, in Illinois? Because, as Your Honors know, the federal system does not, classify its convictions. And, Your Honors, we found, or we gave several different ways that the trial court could look at this without implicating, Apprendi, which requires that any fact other than a prior conviction should be submitted and proved to the jury beyond the reasonable doubt. All of those were rejected. And the first one was that, if you have a mail fraud statute, the first place that you should start is by looking at the Illinois statutes and saying, okay, is there an Illinois mail fraud statute? And in this case, there was a direct analog statute with the exact same elements that said that mail fraud is a Class 3 felony.
So that's essentially an elements-based approach. But Shepard allows courts to look at things like, guilty pleas. And as soon as, at least at the Illinois appellate court level, they look at the guilty plea, they say, well, we can see that Illinois regards the conduct that's admitted to in this guilty plea as of the requisite class.
Again, let me respond to that in 2 points, Your Honor. First of all, Shepherd does say that you can go and you can look at the guilty plea to determine what the conviction was. That's something very different from what happened here, even in the Illinois Appellate Court, where the Illinois Appellate Court looked at the plea agreement to say, well, what could it have been? And again, under the Illinois statute or under Apprendi, the key word there is what was the actual conviction?
That's not quite it. It's what would this mass of facts have turned into if we had been looking at it all in Illinois? They understand that it's a federal conviction for mail fraud, but how, in your view, does that translational process work?
Well, again, I mean,
elements is one way. You could say, well, elements only,
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt, Judge. You could look at elements only. Another way that you could look at it without implicating Apprendi is you could look at, what was Mr. Calloway's actual sentence under the mail fraud conviction, which was 36 months. If you go and you look at the Illinois sentencing ranges, 3 to 5 years as a Class 3 felony. There would be no Apprendi implication. The third way that we gave to the judge was, go and look at the maximum range for the mail fraud conviction, which is 5 years. Again, if you look at the Illinois sentencing scheme, a Class 3 felony is 3 to 5 years.
Let me make certain of this. In your view, does Apprendi prohibit a state court from looking to facts to which the defendant stipulated in pleading guilty?
Your Honor, to answer that question, to a certain extent, yes. First of all, Apprendi does preclude you looking at stipulated facts if you're going to take those stipulated facts and do what essentially the state courts did here, take one crime with one set of elements and transfer it into an entirely second different elements.
In a sense, the court is looking beyond the fact of a conviction, but is it depriving him the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial when it's only looking at facts to which he himself admitted pleading guilty?
Your Honor, first of all, looking at the facts is one thing, but if you look at the plea agreement here, not all of the facts to a theft by deception crime were admitted. Specifically, one of the facts that was never admitted was that Mr. Calloway, or a specific one of his co-defendants, obtained control over any property. If you read through the plea agreement does tell you that he worked for the real estate company Easy Life, that his boss, Mr. Nelson, bought dilapidated properties and fixed them up, that he sold those, that Mr. Calloway's role in this was then to, help find buyers, give them money to use as a down payment, help them fill out certain applications, and based upon that application, the banks and HUD issued mortgages and mortgage insurance.
But I thought the whole theory was that the buyers at that point did get control over HUD money that they never would have gotten had it not been for the illegal.
Judge, that's certainly an inference that can be drawn from the plea agreement, but that fact is not in and of itself contained in the plea agreement. So therefore, what you had to have happen was a judge somewhere, either at the trial level or the appellate level, make that jump from the inference and make a factual finding. And Apprendi is clear, as is Ring, Supreme Court said, any factual finding whatsoever is reserved for the jury. And it doesn't matter how we label it. You can label it as a finding. You can label it as a sentencing enhancement, or as Justice Scalia said, Mary Jane. So any fact that you're going to use must be decided by the jury, especially in a case like this where the state courts are, as I said, essentially taking one crime and metamorphosing it into another one when there's actually a direct analog statute that could have been applied, or you could look at any of the other ways.
But you seem to be saying that unless the plea agreement has the sentence in it, the buyers obtained control over the funds, that's not good enough, that we can't just read this as something that kind of sensibly implies that. How else could they have bought the property and led to, you know, the $132,000 or whatever it was in $132,868 in loss?
Sure, Your Honor. We can sensibly read this, you know, plea agreement and make that deduction from reading it. But the deduction is exactly what is permitted, or I'm sorry, disallowed by Apprendi. That if he was going to, that is a question of fact, that he was entitled to have submitted to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
What's the issue? I mean, what could possibly be said on the other side once you were able to take into account all of the admissions in the plea agreement?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Well, if there's an issue of fact, presumably, you know, there's he said, she said, or something like that, you know, and we see what he said. He makes all these admissions in the plea agreement. Is there any possible evidence where he could say, no, actually, the buyers never had control over the funds?
First of all, the buyers, you know, were not necessarily co-defendants in the scheme. You know, this is what his involvement was, as well as his co-defendant. So, you know, the one factual question that certainly comes up is who got the money and how much did they get? Because in order even for the Illinois trial court here to say that, you know, this was theft by deception over $100,000, therefore it's class one felony. You know, the amount in controversy or the amount of the theft had to be over $100,000. There was no evidence whatsoever in the plea agreement as to what money went to Mr. Calloway. You know, did he get the full, you know, money from the HUD? You know, did he get a commission? None whatsoever. And a jury, you know, when faced with that, Your Honor, could reasonably look at that and say, look, maybe it's theft by deception, but it's certainly not over $100,000, or at least his role is not over $100,000.
Your time is really running out, but I want to ask you, I'm going to change course for just an instant. You don't think that that ADEPA bars relief here, even though the Supreme Court in Beck left open the question of whether the failure to give a lesser included offense instruction amounted to a due process violation.
Your Honor, yes, we do not believe that that ADEPA violates the due process claim here on the lesser included instruction. And there's really two ways that Your Honors can get to that. First, under ADEPA, if a state court decision is contrary to clearly established federal law, then, you know, as determined by the United States Supreme Court, then, you know, ADEPA gives habeas relief. And while Beck, we agree, Your Honor, does not go so far as to extend a lesser included instruction in non-capital cases, the pre-ADEPA cases, specifically the Nichols case, actually makes clear that it's not that this court's review of these types of claims is not based at all on Beck, but is actually based on the Supreme Court's decision in Palco v. Connecticut. Second of all, the other, you know, branch of ADEPA is an unreasonable determination of fact. And if you look at the district court's opinion here, the district court actually notices or says the Illinois appellate court, you know, said that Mr. Calloway should not get a recklessness instruction because of struggling over the gun, because the jury, you know, found that he was, you know, justified in doing so. And as the district court noted, that was clearly contrary to the facts, because if that were the case, Mr. Calloway would have been acquitted. Your Honors, if there's no other questions, I'd like to yield the podium.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Good morning, Mr. Treble.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carl Treble, representing the respondent warden for Illinois. Your Honor, both of petitioner's claims are barred by the ADP.
Let me just get on that last question. I think the interesting issue in this case is the lesser included offense matter over the sentencing issue. But was this charged as a murder case? And how did the lesser included offense of voluntary manslaughter get into the charge?
Your Honor, this was tried as a murder case, and under the Illinois law in place under which he was tried at, which was the 1979 law, in order to find voluntary manslaughter, the jury had to first find that the prosecution had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the elements of murder were proven, but then also find that the defendant had proved by a preponderance of the evidence that there were mitigating circumstances such as that his belief that he could use deadly force was unreasonable.
So the defense then, trial judges always have different sort of temperature levels on lesser included offenses. Are they going to give those to juries because that promotes compromise verdicts and all that? But here, I'm just interested in how it happened that that instruction was given to the jury and a rejection of an involuntary manslaughter, another additional lesser-included offense instruction or option was given to the jury.
Your Honor, I haven't gleaned from the record why exactly the voluntary manslaughter instruction was given, so I'd hate to speculate on that. There's a discussion in the record about why the court rejected the involuntary manslaughter instruction, and the court reviewed the evidence that had been presented at a trial and said that there was no evidence of recklessness. And under the Illinois law at the time, there had to be evidence of recklessness in order to justify an involuntary manslaughter instruction.
You know, I'm right in there with Judge Evans because it seems to me that it's quite possible that a jury might have convicted Mr. Calloway of involuntary manslaughter if it had been instructed on that offense. As he told that story, there was a struggle over a gun. Couldn't a jury have found that he was reckless when he engaged her in that struggle? And everything leading up to the struggle seems to make sense. Here's a woman who always carried a gun in her purse. It's this gun that was carried in her purse. You know, they're both probably inebriated. They're in close quarters in a car. I really had, going through this, an enormous amount of problem understanding why, as Judge Bucklow seemed to, why the evidence would not have supported, very least, an instruction of voluntary manslaughter.
Well, Your Honor, I think reasonable jurists might review the record and disagree on this point. I don't think there was evidence of recklessness per the Illinois definition of recklessness in the Illinois statute. And it's important to remember what we're talking about here is, did the state court correctly interpret state law, which by itself is not normally grounds for habeas relief. But to answer Your Honor's question, there is no evidence of recklessness here because recklessness in Illinois means acting outside of a reasonable standard of care. When you're talking about a struggle
why
with a person...
Why isn't struggling over a loaded gun that's cocked and ready to go acting without reasonable care?
Well, Your Honor, if somebody pulled a gun on me, I would think I would struggle with them, and a reasonable person would probably struggle with them to avoid being shot. But that's a matter for...
Wait a minute. You're the unreasonable person or you're the reasonable person?
Well, I think a reasonable person normally, Your Honor. But
I'm not sure it'd be reasonable for me to struggle with somebody with a loaded gun. I'd just as likely be shooting myself.
Right. And as I said, Your Honor, perhaps reasonable minds could disagree that the Illinois law should have been interpreted differently by the Illinois court. So even setting aside the recklessness factor, the question before the court is not whether or not the Illinois court was correct in interpreting Illinois law. Rather, the question is, did the state appellate court violate clearly established U.S. Supreme Court precedent? And as this court recognized in Lockhart, where the Supreme Court has dropped a footnote expressly declining to decide whether or not something could even be a constitutional violation, then the state court's decision on this matter could not have been objectively unreasonable. Thus, there's no need to even reach this court's pre-AEDPA fundamental miscarriage of justice test. I'd like to touch on one point.
Should it come into our consideration that after the AEDPA, whatever, that the failure to instruct on a lesser included offense may warrant habeas relief when it results in a a fundamental miscarriage of justice.
No, Your Honor. This court in Nichols created the fundamental miscarriage of justice test as a response to a question it faced in that case, which was...
But I don't think this court created... I mean, there is Supreme Court precedent from before anything this court said in Nichols, and the Supreme Court since Beck has acknowledged that there could be fundamental miscarriages of justice. So I think looking solely at Supreme Court sources, which is what we, of course, have to do under AEDPA, this is a theory that goes beyond actually instructional errors or anything else.
I think, Your Honor, the proper way to view this is under Nichols, what the court was doing was it was faced with the question of how do we apply the proper amount of deference to state courts in this specific circumstance of a lesser-included offense instruction.
What if the Supreme Court had never decided the question whether you could use a roulette wheel to decide on somebody's guilt or innocence, and that were to come up under AEDPA? Are we required to say, well, no Supreme Court decision, therefore the Illinois courts can't be overruled on, or, you know, we can't come to a contrary result in habeas?
In that case, Your Honor, I think there is a good argument that habeas relief would apply under something like the general principle of the fundamental miscarriage of justice test. The difference between the two circumstances is here we have a specific test that was discussed, and in Nichols the court was asking what deference do we give to the state court's decision, because we're not going to just jump into every case. AEDPA answered that question for the court in 1996. Nichols came out in 1983. AEDPA says that the standard of deference is unreasonable application of U.S. Supreme Court precedent.
Or there's another aspect in Williams versus Taylor that says an unreasonable refusal to extend a Supreme Court precedent to a situation which it clearly should be extended.
Yes, Your Honor. That's a plurality portion of Williams v. Taylor that the court has
but never... which has been followed.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, there could possibly be a hypothetical where it would expand to falling under the general principle that this just violates constitutional norms. Where the fundamental miscarriage of justice test comes from is this general principle in the Constitution that you have a right to a fair trial. Here, the Supreme Court in the footnote in Beck dealt, though, with the specific circumstances and said, we're not going to reach this specific issue and decide whether this is even a constitutional violation. And this court described the Beck opinion as pulling this constitutional rule essentially out of thin air. I'm paraphrasing here, but the court stated that there's nothing in the Constitution that specifically requires the giving of a lesser-included offense instruction.
Unless
there is this general principle met of a fundamental miscarriage of justice, right? But it's not... the plain text is not in the Constitution, Your Honor.
It could be.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, and perhaps...
The Constitution doesn't say lots of things, so Batson isn't in the Constitution either, and yet the Supreme Court recognizes that as a constitutional rule.
Right, precisely, Your Honor. The U.S. Supreme Court has recognized it as a clearly established rule. Here, the U.S. Supreme Court has clearly declined to decide the issue, and thus the state court's decision could not have been objectively unreasonable. We're not arguing that the fundamental miscarriage of justice, Your Honor, that test has been overruled or is no longer good law. In cases where the original filing was before 1996 or in cases where the state court failed to reach the issue on the merits, then AEDPA would not apply, and this court's case law would still apply.
Could I quickly ask you how... In a situation where there is actually no conviction under state law, the argument actually that Mr. Monroe was stressing, you could have the Almendarez-Torres. The whole purpose of the prior conviction exception to the Apprendi rule, I'll call it Apprendi because we're in state court here, is that prior convictions uniquely are reliable. There's been testing of the... of the merits of the case, the person has had the full panoply of constitutional rights, and when you start saying, well, here's a conviction for A, but it looks a lot like B, C, D, E, and F, that rationale seems to start falling apart.
And that's the argument that Justice Thomas put forth in his concurring opinion.
Well, but it's not, I'm not going anywhere near as far as Justice Thomas. I'm just saying if there has, in fact, been a prior conviction for a particular offense, fine, you know, we, of course, have scrupulously followed Almendarez-Torres. But if instead of it being, you know, say, wire fraud, let's suppose we're in the federal side, we say, gee, this conduct looked a lot like an antitrust offense, too, so let's just assume there's been a prior conviction for an antitrust felony, and sometimes there's overlap. But we haven't gone that far with Almendarez-Torres. We've said it's got to be a prior conviction for this conduct. And here the court's kind of off there hypothesizing out into the outer reaches.
Well, I disagree that they're going into the outer reaches, Your Honor. Petitioner pled guilty and in his plea agreement stated the facts that were necessary to support the theft by deception conviction.
Which, of course, the trial court had no idea of at the time. The trial court didn't have that plea agreement in front of him, right?
It's unclear from the record, Your Honor. Petitioner's counsel was there and he says that that's true. But it was before the state appellate court when it issued its decision, which is what this court looks back upon. And it also was before the trial court, even according to petitioner, before the trial court ruled on a motion for reconsideration. But to get to Your Honor's point about the state courts possibly going too far, federal courts are faced with an exact analog situation where they're looking under immigration or sentencing law to a foreign conviction and determining whether or not that foreign conviction falls within the federal statute. In Taylor versus United States, the U.S. Supreme Court constructed both a categorical approach and a modified categorical approach.
And in the modified approach, the court says, here are the fundamental elements that are going to map up onto the offense we're looking for. And I'm worried that here we've really gone pretty far afield from wire fraud. Not like the court was looking for, you know, it's a wire fraud offense. Is there anything that looks like wire fraud in Illinois law, which is what the court was doing in Taylor? It's burglary. Is there anything that looks like burglary? This is a much more open-ended process that you're arguing for.
Well, and I think, again, Your Honor, reasonable minds might disagree on this, and the U.S. Supreme Court might eventually either tailor Almendarez-Torres or completely reject it, but the state court was not objectively unreasonable in relying on the recidivism exception, given Taylor versus United States, Shepard versus United States, Apprendi and Almendarez-Torres, and even Booker and Blakely. We continue to see the recidivism exception being
Then I don't have any issue with the recidivism, that it's not necessarily recidivism for everything under this particular Illinois statute. The Illinois statute only allows a recidivism enhancement for certain kinds of offenses, and I think that's where just sort of willy-nilly saying, oh, we think this looks a lot like something that fits the offense is
right.
Troubling.
And, Your Honor, this court was faced with similar circumstances in a case where there was a question about the timing of the prior conviction, and the argument was made, well, the timing of the prior conviction is going too far in the same way that the classification of the offense is going too far. And this court rejected that application, rejected that argument. And therefore, the state court could not have been objectively unreasonable in also deciding that the recidivism exception of Apprendi does cover these circumstances. One word real quick, Your Honor, about the obtained control argument. The state court specifically rejected the argument that petitioner had personally obtained control of the property. They said that under Illinois law, and indeed it's in the statute, you either have to personally obtain control or someone that you're working with has to obtain control. On page RA35, on page SA16, which is a separate appendix, page 16, the plea agreement specifically states that the buyers were given mortgages and mortgage insurance that they would not otherwise qualify for. The loss amounted to over $100,000. If the loss amounted to over $100,000, then surely the amount that was stolen was greater than the $100,000. Unless there are any further questions, Your Honor, I'd ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment below.
Thank you, Mr. Trepo. Monroe.
Your Honors, I realize I've already cut into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to quickly make three follow-up points. Not to belabor the Apprendi point, but to pick up on a couple things that the state argued in response to specific questions. I believe it was Judge Wood who said something to the effect that the trial courts here were hypothesizing into the outer reaches. And the response to that was that, you know, we disagree that it's going into the outer reaches. But what they did not disagree about was that there is some level of hypothesizing here. And that is the exact danger in what happened here in the Illinois trial court, in the Illinois appellate court, in the district court. At which point, you know, do you stop hypothesizing and say that we have no longer violated the Sixth Amendment? You know, there was a direct analog statute on hand. There was a sentence that was imposed of approximately 3 years that was within the Class 3 felony. And the maximum range for mail fraud at that time was a Class 5 felony. So, you know, it does beg the question, you know, for lower courts of when do you stop? I mean, the taking one crime and metamorphosing it into another. Federal court crimes are one example. State court crimes are another example of where this can pop up, where instead of using classifications of 1, 2, 3, they use A, B, and C. Second of all, just to pick up on the constitutional protections that are provided by, you know, the fact of a prior conviction, none of those constitutional protections were here. What the Illinois courts essentially did was take the criminal justice system and turn it on its head. There was no notice by indictment that he was going to be tried of theft by deception. He had no right to hold the state guilty beyond a reasonable doubt on the claim of theft by deception. He didn't have a chance to confront witnesses on a claim for theft by deception. None of those things were present here. And I see my time has expired.
Please finish your thought.
Okay. None of those constitutional protections were afforded here, where basically instead of saying, you know, the state, you go and prove Mr. Calloway guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of the crime of theft by deception, he was put in the exact opposite position of having to prove that he had never committed the crime of theft by deception. And I respectfully submit that that does turn Apprendi as well as the entire Constitution on its head. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, we respectfully request that Your Honors reverse the District Court's opinion and remand with appropriate instructions. Thank you.
Mr. Monroe, you were appointed, were you not?
Not appointed, Your Honor. We did take the case pro bono before the trial.
You have the thanks of the court for fine representation. Mr. Treble, you have the same thanks. Fine representation that you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be taken under advisement.